Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. I hope y'all are having a beautiful quasi-spring day. We got a lot of rain yesterday, and it was a little gloomy this morning, but goodness gracious, what a beautiful, glorious day that we're having here. I hope it's the same for you. And we appreciate you joining us for another edition of Midrats, especially those that are joining us live. We got Ron and Paul in the chat room. And while we're here this afternoon, if you are with us live, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. You can join Paul and Ron there. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, but especially today where we don't have a guest, we have our free-for-all format. If you have some topics you'd like for us to address or you want us to clarify something we may have talked about earlier, that is the perfect place to do it. And with that going on, we already cheated and talked ahead of time, so I think we know what we're going to talk about. Eagle One, good to talk to you again today.
Hey, Sal. Good afternoon. It's beautiful here where I am, too.
It's all glorious. Well, My bracket for the NCAA is going just fine, but until you get through Sweet 16, you never really know.
Yeah, well, congratulations to all the weird teams that have showed up there. NC State has gone on a remarkable run, winning seven games in 12 days.
That's right, and at the NCAA turn, I mean the ACC tournament, I think they got five games in 5 days. And you look at all the, it's almost back to the way it is in a just world. ACC really has a lot of great teams in the tournament. It's nice to see. There have been a while where there were just a couple of ACC teams that were really something to talk about. But yeah, the folks in the ACC have a lot to entertain themselves this March. I thought about it for a few years, and maybe this is something we conspire with next year, but a lot of people do similar stuff. But I always thought it might be entertaining to do a March. We can't call it Hack Madness because that's already taken up by Comfortably Smug and the folks on Ruthless. But we ought to do like the Navalist March Madness. I think we can find enough people, if people are interested enough to vote on that. See who would flesh out on that. Might cause a few bones of contention, but that'll always be fun. I think we can find, what do you need to find, 64 people who write about Navy terms?
Yeah, that's probably about right. And, we could also try things like over and unders on number of commanding officers relieved during any given year.
all profits go to Navy relief, yes.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, that we justify all sorts of things.
That's so cruel.
Talking about Navy relief, for the listeners, it was kind of fun when we do, unless it's a situation where I, of course, have my usual technical difficulties that can only dial in 30 seconds before we go live. Sometimes that happens with guests. We're having our free-for-alls, our melee format. I don't know if there's a difference between the two. Maybe it's just a different way of saying the same thing. We will try in the pre-show to do what are you interested in and find some overlap, see if there's a topic. And there was a topic today that I know for our listeners here, unless you've been in SEER school for the last week, you've heard the story, and it was at the top of both of our lists. And I guess that's a good thing to kick off on, because for the majority of our listeners, you know what engineering is. You know how complicated and hard it can be, especially when you're dealing with a plant that's a big deal. Those that maybe don't deal with the groundwork in engineering, what they do know is our Navy is at least a half dozen amps short. And with our long deck, our large deck amphibs, we really seem to have some challenges. We lost the Bonhomer Shard, and lo and behold, we almost lost the Bog. We had the report come out about some significant problems with the Boxer, and I had a quote, but show that a great
Well, you're breaking up, but I think what you're looking for is the quote that I said that the it's in one of the cover letters for the report, and I'll put the report location up for people in the chat room. But the quote is these failures had a direct measurable impact on USS Boxer's upcoming deployment and impeded the overall accomplishment of the strike group missions. The Navy's Pacific Fleet was less ready and less capable because of USS Boxer's shortfalls. That is, that's not, that's just damning. That is
it is.
Calling
and folks,
it what it is.
And if folks wanted to Google it, and when we put the podcast up, I'll have a link on the show page that I'll add to it. But over on Maritime Executive, they have a link to the large report too, but also some good commentary. It's titled Amphib USS Boxer Sidelined by General Complacency and Breakdowns. Now, you mentioned the deployment, and a lot of times when there's engineering problems, yes, there are human factors, but there's also, they'll kind of rightfully, in many cases, hedge things about certain material shortfalls. But they're pretty straightforward here. They said, USS Boxer, the flagship of the Boxer Amphibious Ready Group, or would have been under normal circumstances. However, she has been in various stages of repair and preparation since 2022. She missed her latest scheduled deployment in the Pacific, all because of human factors, according to the recent command investigation. That's pretty damning. And they're pretty clear that it was, and as it is with usually with things such as this, it is senior leadership. What you allow, what you inspect, what you reward, what you punish it. But they clearly say it's the senior leadership in the engineering department.
Yeah, they really hammered them. And part of the problem, I see it. I mean, in the report, it notes that a lot of the senior, you know, the Captain XO level had no experience with steam-powered ships. They all came from gas turbine ships, and you know they didn't receive, I guess, any special training before they went to a ship that was steam powered, and it's a different world. And if you're trying to supervise and figure out what's going on with those guys down in the hole, you really, I mean, most of us got training in the basic steam cycle when I was a midshipman. I'm not sure if they still do that because we don't have all that many steam powered ships, but. It's frustrating to have, what would they say, a general atmosphere of complacency or something. It's just amazing.
It's a quote from an investigation. A safe, professional, and procedurally compliant work in the engineering department. He felt a direct, measurable impact on USS Boxer's upcoming deployment and impeded the overall accomplishment of the group's mission. It's, you almost wonder, because our COs of our aircraft carriers are go to school to understand the power plant that's running their carrier, with steam powered plants no longer being what you deal with from your midshipman crews on. I wonder if there's been some consideration that just like we sent our large deck aircraft carriers to nuke school, maybe we need to put our COXO through steam school, wherever that is nowadays.
Yeah, I'd recommend that. I mean, it used to be that all our ships were steam powered, so it wasn't that big a deal. You did get the basic training, as I said, the, you know, basic steam cycle, and most of us did a tour rolling through the engineering department where you had to play with the boilers and all that good stuff. But I don't think that's done much anymore. And with gas turbines, I mean, I've never been on a gas turbine ship except as a tourist. So But I understand it's a lot easier. I mean, I used to take, our chief engineers would have to go to the light off the boilers, you know, hours before we got underway. And now they just go press a button, and I think pretty much you're moving. So it is a different world, and I would guess that one of the lessons learned out of this ought to be we've got to make sure the senior level people above the chief engineer and the main propulsion assistant have some knowledge of what's supposed to be going on down there.
And we've also talked recently about some of the challenges in industry where even if we want to expand our shipbuilding and ship maintenance and our shipyards, that we're going to have to build up the trained civilian artisans, for lack of a better phrase, that are going to do the welding and repair. And they kind of put the shipyards on report a bit, where they said, but again, it goes back to supervisor inspections, NAVC, call your office type of things, quote, numerous deficiencies, end quote, in parentheses, nonconforming parts, poor quality control, non-OEM supervision, end of parentheses, have been noted in recent overhauls. The repetitive overhaul repair of full drag blowers on the boiler may be an indicator of shortfalls in contractor experience necessary to conduct steam plant repairs.
Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Well, you were breaking up, so I couldn't tell whether you'd finished. Yeah,
I don't know I don't know what's causing that. It's weird.
Yeah, some of the reports went off to on the MPA, the main propulsion assistant, and quite an experienced guy, apparently over 27 years in the Navy, but he was apparently standing by when a lot of these casualties are occurring and wasn't doing the proper training to make sure they didn't occur. And, that's where you get that. Either he didn't know how to be a supervisor or he just wasn't interested. I have no idea. But, the amount of people forget how the amount of training to do anything on a Navy ship is ongoing. You're doing it all the time. You get people trained and then you run drills to keep them up to snuff. And, to have this level of lack of interest. And the main thing they looked at was the rotation of they ran the jacking gear and were turning the reduction gear without proper lubrication for a couple of hours, and that should never happen. You have checklists. It's not like this is something that comes out, falls out of the sky. Well, let's go down and run through the reduction gear just for the heck of it. No, this is part of a routine maintenance, and there's checklists for this stuff. And apparently they weren't following any of that guidance. So, I see that somebody has recommended the DFC, a discharge for cause, against the MPA. That's down low in the bowels, but you really got to think that the senior leadership, who's doing the PQS checking, who's signing off on this stuff, they have to go up to the at least in the old days, you had to go up to the senior people in both the departments and above to get your PQS signed off. And if the people at the very top don't know what they're doing, it is then you're signing off PQS, they don't understand either. So that there's a level of problems here that really troubles me.
I guess in some ways we're lucky that they did not suffer a significant engineering casualty or another fire. I mean, how many amphibs can we burn up in San Diego? I don't think we have any more fireboats than we did before.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not sure that there was that much danger burning up, but you could burn out, lots of bearings and things like that if you're not lubricating stuff. So, it's been taken for action. It sounds like they've taken it very seriously. It's too bad that it comes to this, because otherwise the ship, if you look at the other aspects of what that ship is supposed to do, they were going through a lot of really good stuff. They had, all kinds of awards for excellence in all the other areas except for engineering, which says a lot about you know, what happens when you don't know what the engineering plant, how the engineering plant is supposed to be operated, and who's supposed to be doing what down there.
Yeah, it was one good thing about it, though, is to our benefit that as a Navy, when there is such substandard performance, that we don't just do an investigation that's clear-eyed, but we make it public. It's kind of the same reason why I support returning to what the standard was before 2010, where we had our in-serves unclass and available. I think that the general public and the taxpayer have a right to see what its armed services is doing in its money. And you can do it in an unclassified manner. If you need a classified addendum, you can do that. But you know, stepping back from the specifics of the occasion, when you're looking at where are some very good, positive cultural things that we have in our Navy, the fact that we make these public so you and I can Monday morning quarterback it from a distance, I think is something everybody should, in a way, be proud of.
Yeah, I agree. By the way, we should mention that Sal Macragliano, the other Sal, as we like to call him, is celebrating the third anniversary of his What's Going On with Shipping program. And I think that's really impressive. As we said, I think last week, he's provided such a valuable resource and insight into matters that most people would have no clue about were it not for him and guys like John Conrad and some others who understand a lot more about the shipping industry than the rest of us have probably ever learned.
Can we brag that we had him on Midrats for years before he brought his own podcast?
Yes. I think it's like, when Johnny Carson used to sponsor young comedians, not that Sal's a comedian, although he is pretty funny, that then he could take pride in that he introduced the world to Steve Martin or somebody. I think that we can say that, yeah, we gave him his start in show business.
we'll take at least 1% credit for that. And I just pulled up his page on YouTube. And he has 205,000 subscribers. And, we talk about, we had an episode on it last month about sea blindness. A lot of people talk about, well, nobody's really interested in this business. Well, that's not accurate. Sal has got 205,000 followers on his niche of niche maritime podcasts. One of it is he does a very good job informing, and he does it in a good manner. So, again, you have to have the right messenger in that regard. But between him and John Conrad, I think they are doing the majority of the public-facing communication on one of the most critical parts, most underserved parts of our economy. And they deserve a lot of credit. And they've both been at it, especially John Conrad, for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see somebody in Congress is beginning to pay attention to some of this. If you look at the budget that just came out, there are some things in there that are suggesting somebody's been paying attention to some of the stuff that John and Sal, the other Sal, have been saying for years, and even some things that we've been saying for years. So that's good.
Yeah, it's good to see, and I do know for a fact that there are people up on the Hill, both members of Congress, maybe a senator. I don't know. I don't have as much visibility there. I'm not fancy enough for the Senate. But there are some Senate staffers, I know for sure, and quite a few staffers on the Hill that do listen to Sal and read John Conrad stuff. It does make, and you and I have talked about this for years, is there is a conversation going on out there, but are you part of it? Are you making an effort to get out there? And you don't even have to be one of the top 10, 20 people out there. If you're writing good content on a topic of interest, it will get attention and it will get ears in, get in front of the right ears and the right eyes. And there's plenty of room, not just in the maritime arena, but especially in the Air Force arena and the Coast Guard arena. There are some good Army sources out there, though they can be kind of limited. I don't know of many as Marines, but there is plenty of room in this space for people who have the knowledge and the desire to join that conversation about these topics. That it's underserved. You know, here we are in 2024. I still say this sector of the information space is underserved, and Modern War Institute does a great job. There are other ones that do a great job as well, but there's still plenty of room out there. There are no walls. There's no finite bin for you to fit stuff. There's the bin will expand to match your bandwidth every time in this information space. So it's something everybody should go. This is good. We just need to have more good people that are willing to sustain the effort. Sal and, you know, John Conrad and Sal, and, you know, you and I as well. We didn't just start doing this 6 months ago. You know, we were content with going with just a couple people. And it's grown over the years for most of the folks involved. As I always do, I encourage a lot of people. If you've got something to say, Substack doesn't cost anything. Start typing away. Type away, just remember, friends come and go, but enemies accumulate.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing to point out. That if you take a position on something, somebody's going to, you know, you can find that somebody's going to take the opposing view to what you said, and in some cases, if they're in a position to do things, you will find that they will find a way to get to you somehow. Or at you somehow, so that you have to be aware if you're gonna tell the truth. They're out there. There are some people out there who don't like that, and I would take for example the saga of the LCS that the big Navy has realized. I mean, I don't know when the light bulb exactly went off that they've acquired these things and that they're functionally useless. Somebody was talking about, why are there no literal combat ships in the literals fighting the Houthis? And, you know, we all know the answer. They're not capable of doing anything. And, you know, it is when you look back at the original concept of what the LCS was supposed to be, or what was proposed by the admirals that were pushing the Street Fighter concept and all that, it was completely different than what we ended up with because, as I noted in a X post, you know, the LCS became the horse designed by a committee, and just, you know, they got sold some real, we'll have this module ready for you kind of thing. And no, that's not the way you do it.
Yeah, and it's, and part of it, a lot of it had to do with the culture that Vern Clark had in the early double zeros. Where it was kind of merciless if anybody opposed it. Simply, I think I've heard some people make the excuse that, well, he didn't want Rumsfeld to yell at him. How old are you? You know, you've got 4 stars. What'd you get them for? But that's water under the bridge. But a lot of it also, I think, needs to go to Congress and congressional oversight. And I said earlier this week in a private group setting, when the floor was open, I said, and this question, this comment of mine is prompted by Paul in the chat room, and a question that Paul put in the chat room that kind of came into something I had talked about earlier this week. But the last election cycle, we lost Representative Elaine Luria, who, regardless of her political party and her political stances, which I really don't care about, what I cared about with her was the fact that she knew the Navy, she knew her business, her mind and her heart were in the right place, and she held people accountable in the committee room. We haven't replaced her on her side of the aisle, and I find that very unfortunate. This cycle, we're going to lose, even though he's a Marine, I won't hold it against him, Representative Mike Gallagher from the Republican side of the House up in the Green Bay area in Wisconsin. He is not going to be running for re-election after 8 years. He also has been very direct in the committee room. He's been very inquisitive. He's always had a very open mind. He had very good instincts. He's going to go on and do what he needs to do, but it leaves a gap in Congress that we really need. Not just the Navy, all the military services need congressional oversight. If we've seen anything over the last quarter century, especially in acquisitions, that they cannot babysit themselves very well, but for congressional oversight to work, you not only need people who care and have an interest, but people that have the knowledge in the background such that they know the right questions to ask and they're not intimidated by a bunch of big guys in fancy uniforms on the opposite side of the dais. And who are we? There are a couple people in Congress that will have to step into the gap, but that's a back-to-back punch for those that are concerned about the Navy. Luria and now Gallagher. It's unfortunate, but here we are.
Well, but then also our friend Brian McGrath, a few other folks were supposed to be on this Navy, I don't know what the remember the name of it, a commission to study the Navy. And
commission on the future of the Navy.
Future of the Navy. And we got two or three appointments, and then it just disappeared. And I guess it's run out of its period of potential operability. I mean, how does Congress do that? You were talking about acquisition. Think things like the F-35. One of the selling points of the F-35 was that pieces of it were being made all over the country, so everybody got a piece of the pie. You know, this is not the way to run things. I mean, you can't, if the Center of Excellence for Building Aircraft is in, I don't know, Southern California, then by gosh, build them there. Do we really need to have components coming from Upper East Uzbekistan, Maine, or whatever, you know, some remote hole in the wall in Vermont? I just get appalled when everybody, you know, there's something in it for me, and I can tell people in my district that I got a piece of the F-35. We've got to change the way we do business and make sense out of it. I mean, if we're going to build ships in Cleveland, Ohio, great. You know, let's build ships there. Let's make it a center of excellence. It would solve some problems. If the Gulf Coast is going to be a center of excellence, let's really work on getting people there. If Norfolk, which has a lot of assets now, facilities now, is still looking for workers, let's spend the money and get the workers and get the training and get people in there making decent money doing the nation's work. Let's not worry about whether or not the people in Bellevue, Nebraska are somehow impacted by not having a naval shipyard component in their town. Of course, they have off an Air Force base.
Yeah, I'll add a link in the comment section to the podcast. But for those that are with us live, if you want to go over to Brian McGrath's Substack, you can find a link on my Substack, but you can just do conservativewahoo.substack.com. He did a post, I think it was last week, titled A Lost Opportunity, where he talks about that because he was one of the members. And let's name names for a second. And this is where, and I've seen this a little bit, and it's really frustrated me, and I've mentioned this to people on both sides of the aisle, a strong Navy is a nonpartisan issue. It should not be a partisan issue. But for some reason, people want to make it that. I've seen people on both sides doing it, and it's unfortunate because the seas don't have a political party. But the committee started off pretty strong, where the Senate Majority Leader, Thomas Ross, actually, the Senate Majority Leader is Senator Schumer. He appointed Thomas Ross in February of 2023. The House Armed Services Chairman, who's Republican, he's the one that appointed Brian McGrath. The Senate Majority Leader, who at the time was not Schumer. It was the turtle from Kentucky. Oh, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. Anyway,
Mitch.
You know what I'm talking about. He appointed Mackenzie Eaglin, the Senate Armed Services Committee ranking member, also a Republican, appointed Mitchell Waltman, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Republican, nominated Scott O'Neill. That was June. That was something happened in June where it was decided that they were going to let this die. The Minority Leader of the House of Representatives, Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat, nominated nobody. The House Armed Services Committee member, which I think is Representative Smith, no nomination at all, and very disappointing. The Senate Armed Services Chairman, which is Senator Reid, who's been very good on especially naval issues, he didn't nominate anybody. The only reason I could see is sometime in midsummer there was a political decision made that I don't understand. Maybe somebody else can explain it to me. They decided they did not want this to take place. And as Brian points out, we've got a Middle Eastern contingency that required two carrier strike groups to go on there. We are in a shooting war with the Houthi rebels in a very interesting way that should be informing how we build our future fleet. We have embarrassingly bad problems with our submarine industrial base that is also jeopardizing, it appears, AUKUS being able to properly get fleshed out. There's lots of issues that could have been helped by that committee, but for reasons I do understand, it's not going to happen. So unfortunate.
Yeah, and you know, let's take the issue of what we should be learning from the Red Sea operations. I mean, first thing is one of the things we should learn and ask constantly is, what is the end state we are trying to achieve? Set that aside for a second. And the issue becomes, what if ships are so vulnerable to these cheap, inexpensive, relatively speaking, missiles and unmanned aircraft and unmanned surface ships and unmanned subsurface things? We need to really rethink how we're going to, you know, it's kind of like when the Russians, I think it was the Russians, whoever invented the first torpedo attack boats and took everybody by surprise, we're in that stage. You know, this isn't a surprise. Captain Wayne Hughes warned for years about, we have to worry about the missile threat from the beach. The Navy is no longer ships at sea. The Navy includes all these assets ashore that can have an impact on your Navy. And, you know, that was learned during before the Napoleonic Wars. But, you know, a ship's a fool to fight a fort. And a big enough fort with enough supply of weaponry can cause some real problems. And if the bad guys are looking at the way we're responding, you got to figure the bad guys are going, well, we see how they do this. What's our response to the way they do this so that they can't do that if we decide to shoot the same stuff or better stuff at them next time? And it's a cycle. We need to be really concerned about how this works. And I think it's not just the Red Sea. I think the Russians should be learning a lesson, and we should learn from them too, about where you base your military assets, including your ships.
Yeah, yesterday was a dark day for the Polish-built old Cold Warrior LSE, the Rapusha. If I'm pronouncing it correctly, looks like the Ukrainians, using their British Storm Shadows, took out two more. And they are specifically targeting those ships, where people wonder why they're doing it, is they're using that to transport weapons, because they're like all amphibious ships that you and I have been talking about. I forget, I linked to somebody else the Amidrats we did. Like it was episode 5 back in 2010 about the lessons that we learned from the Haiti operations back then. Yes, some nations always come up. The few things are more flexible than an amphibious ship, and they're using these rapushas to move equipment around, weapons around. And in addition to taking out the bridges and road networks, if the Ukrainians can take out what the Russians are using to move men and material around by ship, it makes the logistics problem much harder and funnels it into fewer avenues to deliver that logistical support. And that's why they're being targeted. But in the larger context, you brought it right up. Another maxim next to not attacking forts, if you can help it, though I think Nelson actually attacked a few forts in his day, but you got to do what you got to do sometimes, is you do not have your airfields or your pier side facilities inside range of your enemy's artillery. That has been true since the first flaming arrow came out of somebody's bow. But you have to look at your missile forces and even your air-launched cruise missiles as an extension of, and aircraft were originally seen as just a different type of artillery. And the Ukrainians are able to reach out and touch the piers in Sevastopol, which is why they've moved some of their naval stuff further east to a place I can't pronounce, near the Kerch Bridge and east of there even, that when we look at the Western Pacific, and we look at the Chinese missile force that they have and are continuing to build, and then you overlay where our fixed air bases, supply depots, and naval facilities are, you have a really, really interesting challenge on your hand. And, you know, going back to what we've talked about with the Red Sea and their little comment about the littoral combat ship, one thing the littoral combat ship can't do is it's still got a hangover from the old bog hammer threat, which it could barely take care of even if it wanted to. It cannot defend itself from any type of aerial threat of any measure, much less some of the modern stuff, in spite of the fact they are not small ships. They're large ships. They're just poorly designed by bad theory, and they're too vulnerable. There are the French and even the Italian Frem frigates have been able to put on a good show, as have the German large frigates, which are really destroyers, but they don't have much of a number there to work with. I think the Dutch frigates have done a good job. What are they? They're large frigates. You could say the Frem is a regular size frigate. It all depends on where you want to draw the lines, but they're multi-mission capable. They were designed to have a lot of tactical flexibility for whatever threat they happen to be put in front of, which is really smart for a small navy. You can't have a bunch of specialized ships. The Burke is the same way. When you actually, especially some of the different flights of the Arleigh Burkes, varsity football level anti-submarine warfare capability, but they also have varsity level anti-air capability. That's one of the big takeaways. And I want to send a note to a couple of our friends here. I really hope somewhere, somebody is already putting forth the requirements for the Flight 2 Constellation, which is our version of the FREM, based upon what we've seen the last 24 to 36 months with Red Sea and also in Ukraine. Because I think the Flight 1, it was designed to get the funding and get across the finish line, not unlike Arleigh Burke Flight 1s. But I think we clearly need a Flight 2, if for no other reason than even though that design can take a 5-inch gun, the 76-millimeter gun, Alto Malera, has actually been doing a very good job in the Red Sea when used by our allies to take the lower tier level drones out, and also has a pretty good capability against subsonic cruise missiles. That would be nice to have as opposed to the LCAS 57 millimeter up front. So yeah, there are lessons that I hope are being taken on board right now that seem pretty obvious, at least to me.
Yeah, I mean the Royal Navy was for a while pretty good about having. I mean, they developed these anti-air frigates. I guess they were destroyers. I mean, they were specifically designed to take on the defense of a carrier group or whatever, as far as anti-aircraft stuff. You know, they were not so big on ASW because ASW was hard from the surface and a lot easier from submarines. And so if you're going to operate in an area where you've got submarines, you really need to worry about protecting your surface ships. You know, I'm not sure that's a bad idea. We just need to, if we're going to make that, you know, is it good to have general purpose ships, or is it good to have a whole bunch of ships that do one thing, you know, other ships that do one thing really well, and then you go from there. I mean, that is always the challenge in trying to figure out what the Navy should look like, I guess. And, you know, the threat du jour, especially since these unmanned capabilities now they're everywhere. It's not just the air. It's you know, these undersea things, the stealth boats that are, I mean, they kind of mimic the drug runners off South America. It's a challenge, and we've really got to think hard about what we should be doing and where we should be doing it. I mean, how close to if we're going to get that close to shore, you know, what is the gain? And that's the other question. What are we doing there? Are we waiting for we don't want to do anything too dramatic in Yemen by taking out the Houthis with troops, because we don't really want to invade yet another country, and we don't want to. So we're just trying to get them to keep their head down, I guess, until Israel can claim that Hamas is no longer a problem, and then we get these piers, these floating pier, fixed pier, whatever we're building, going to send when everybody finally shows up, what we're going to have off there to get supplies across the shore for the innocent civilians of Gaza, and hopefully Hamas will be toast by then. But I'm sure that, like many things, like ISIS, they keep rearing their ugly head.
ISIS-K just reminded the Russians they're not going anywhere yesterday as well. I also think that, you know, that planning assumption you just outlined, that once Israel gets through mopping up in Gaza, that the Houthis are going to go back in their box. And what if that planning assumption is not valid? One thing I don't understand, I feel like I understand why they're doing it, but there's no logic to it, is why we are allowing all this money to still go to Iran. And in many ways, we are protecting Iran. The Houthis are just a different branch of the Iran Revolutionary Guard. There are parallel efforts in the executive branch, which I think is, they think they're playing four-dimensional chess, but they're playing hopscotch with their shoes tied together. I don't see how this works out well at all. And if I was Iran, I would tell the Houthis we'll do everything we can to ship stuff to you, but you just keep at it. There's no downside. We even saw today this morning I saw where they actually hit a Chinese ship. I think some people assume that the Houthis have perfect knowledge of everything that's underway. I got news for everybody. We don't either. I don't think they intentionally hit a Chinese ship. I think they probably thought it was something else. They don't have the best maritime surveillance organization out there in the world. But I wouldn't read too much in the fact that they hit a Chinese ship. Those things will happen. But that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, they did promise Russia and China free access through the Red Sea. Either somebody gave them the wrong information, or the Chinese ship has sometimes happens, had an altered AIS. So who knows? I mean, that and then maybe the Iranian ship that sits off there and helps the Houthis target made a mistake themselves. Things happen. Yeah, no, I agree with you. We seem to be very supportive of we're just dumping money on Iran, and everybody goes, well, no, they can't. They have to use that for humanitarian stuff. Money is fungible. If you give them $18 billion here, then there's $18 billion that they didn't have to use for some purpose before that can be used for some other, some nefarious purpose. And it's not like they like us. They're pretty secure. They got 90% of their oil outflow right now goes to China. So China has a vested interest in keeping the Strait of Hormuz open, but China doesn't really, they're giving them money for this oil and they're providing them with models for some of their weapons. It's a very bad axis that I see with China and Iran and Russia and North Korea now, which seems to be a new arms pool for all these places.
Yeah, the Hermit Kingdom is also just completely militarized. So if you need a 122 or 152 millimeter artillery shells, Lord knows how much stuff they have stored away. There was an interesting YouTube spot a few months ago where the Ukrainians actually captured some of the they were Grad rockets that had come from North Korea, and they cracked them open, and they were pointing out all the shoddy workmanship where they're not quite I think they would be the dent and blemish selection if you're value shopping. They're not quite the quality control you would expect, but that's okay. That's not their method of war. It should get expected. And I think that that bringing of North Korea back into the Russian fold, I don't know what type of deals they're making to get weapons out of there, but it can't be good in the long run. The only thing positive is the fact that South Korea is stronger now than she's ever been before, and she's getting stronger. So North Korea, even the experts in North Korea really don't know what they're up to, but they are getting some good money out of the Russians. The Russians are getting money from India that buys their oil, and they're turning that money around and probably giving it to North Korea giving North Koreans food to get the weapons. So they all have their own little side economy that they're running to keep that war sustained in Ukraine.
Yeah, let me go back to something you talked about earlier, which was the why the Houthis are doing what they're doing. There was a pretty good article in Maritime Executive about why they do it. And here's just give you the headline. Why Houthi attacks in the Red Sea are likely to persist? They're popular. And that, every time it seems that somebody attacks the West, there's a whole group of people who get all excited, and they think that's great news. And so as long as it doesn't really affect the majority of the population around them, because we're trying very hard not to take out mosques and schools and all that stuff, as we always do, then, it is a game of cat and mouse, and sometimes they like being the mice. They can scurry around and, we're not really impacting anything, and they're getting free stuff from Iran to harass the West.
Yeah, we are really playing two different games. And eventually this has got to come to a head, because we can't be continued to held accountable to global international order everybody keeps talking about. We keep giving a pass to other people that hold two tiers of justice on the international. I think a classic example of that is 600 nautical miles from Hainan Island, which is properly part of the People's Republic of China. You have some really incredible, not trying to hide it, scenes of the Chinese Coast Guard and some of their maritime militias as well being really aggressive with the fire hoses against the Philippines trying to resupply their sovereign territory that's only disputed by the People's Republic of China. It was really kind of sad to see. It seems with each passing week, too, that Malaysia gets closer and closer into the Chinese orbit, where they just kind of shrugged at what is obviously international bullying by the People's Republic of China. What worries me is how do you escalate past the fire hoses? I guess shouldering or ramming, and then there's fire. So we're kind of running out the clock here on Chinese aggressive versus, at least to this point, Philippine steadfastness. And I don't know how that's going to work out, but I do not see China deciding to de-escalate because they have no reason to right now.
Well, it was the project to cast light on this that we had Brett Sadler on recently talk about, and you know that embarrassed the Chinese. But then they're showing the same images that makes them look bad. They don't care. They don't really, you know, they are not swayed by international opinion. The first thing is they don't really care because they're the Middle Kingdom and everybody owes them obedience and kowtowing and all that good stuff. And it's just the way they operate. I mean, for people who have a reputation for being subtle, they're the least subtle people we've ever dealt with, I think, in so many ways. I mean, when they crack down on people, let's take Tiananmen Square. When they crack down, they don't do it subtly. They do it, in a bold and bloody way. And then when people mention Tiananmen Square, you can't talk to us about that. Look at your own, blah blah. It is just the way they work. And somebody proposed using the LCSs to assist the Philippines. The Philippines have their own Coast Guard gets surrounded by these Chinese Coast Guard ships. I don't know if you've seen the videos on that where they were wouldn't allow them to go in. And then the other day I saw that the anti-submarine nets we used to string across our port entries, like in San Francisco and place like that, keep subs out. Now there was a boat out there pulling along some kind of net or barrier to seal off access to that shoal where those Philippine sailors are living on that rusted out LST. I mean, they are relentless in their pursuit of claiming that they are right and everybody else is wrong, and that the international decisions against them and it was wrong, and they didn't even get a chance to participate because they refused to. And this is in perfect harmony with the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea, because this 9-dash line existed from the time immemorial, and they've always fished these waters. I think where a lot of these countries are. They just get worn out by this nonsense. You can't challenge every stupid lie, every Global Times report. It'll wear you down. And that's where we really do have to support the Philippines and the Vietnamese and the Malaysians and the other countries impacted by this stuff. We have to keep showing the flag, keep doing our, it's not freedom of navigation. We have the right to navigate through those waters. It isn't a matter of us, tiptoeing through there. We should, we need to be even bolder in our efforts to say, no, we're not going to let you get away with claiming the entire South China Sea. You have no right to it. But we'll see how this goes. I'm not enamored of the way we approach China, and I'm not sure any recent administration has been where I would like them to be with us. It's just pathetic in many ways.
I think that's the big question is, and we've made lots of mistakes west of the international dateline in the last decade of neglecting people, but we have a long-standing historical relationship with the Philippines that's pretty unique in the area, and they're not a rich country. They're not a South Korea. They're not Japan. There's a tremendous, and we've talked about this on Midrats before, Philippine diaspora. Everybody's got a relative or two in the U.S. That we really, at this moment in time, when it appears probably not unrelated to this fact, that the PRC has decided that they're going to pick on America's little cousin, neighbor, the Philippines, and almost dare us to do more to support them. And we should take them up on the dare. Because if we let them bully the Philippines, that's a message, one, we lose face. But it also sends a message that if America won't help out and support the Philippines, who will they support? They're not going to support you, Vietnam. They still can't get over when you kick their butt. You know, Japan, what are you going to do when we, you know, control your lifeline to the rest of the world? It just, the second and third order effects by not giving great support to the Filipinos. I don't think they want us to do things for them, but we can help fill some of their capability and material gaps and a rounding error from what we find in the Pentagon couches on a Saturday afternoon that I hope smart people in hard jobs and important places are working on that. I haven't seen that in any of the budget documents, but we have an opportunity here. It's not too late, but if I was wearing my red hat on this and I was red hatting for the PRC, I absolutely would do all that I can to weaken and subdue the Philippines to my will. I just hope that we're going to do more, because when you look at the ships that the Filipinos are sending out there, they could do better.
Yeah, it is it's difficult for people to remember this. We have a treaty with the Philippines that provides that we will come to their defense. And, you know, I've asked this question, I think now for a couple of years, when you begin to get these water hoses, you know, injuring people, when you get these boats, you know, coming either smashing into or attacking assets of the Philippine nation, not just their privately owned fishing boats, but I mean things like these boats that they're sending out to get supplies to the Philippine Marines that are on that LST. At what point does war begin, which would require us to come to their defense, and what point is this is just bullying and not war yet? You know, that to me is the, and you know, I'm sure that we're trying to put the best face on it here. Well, they're not really doing anything warlike yet, and I'm not convinced. I think they're going to push it as close as they can until see how far that edge goes before we do anything to really respond.
I have to come in right now. One thing that I absolutely am humbled and greatly appreciate that, and it just tickles me, is a lot of our friends and former guests do listen to the show live. They won't weigh into the chat room, but now that they get messages, and you have to respect the entrepreneurial spirit. I just got a note from Claude Barabé. Let me quote him directly, because I read all this stuff.
Is he pushing his book again?
If only there was a novel about China interfering with the Philippines. And he's right. And we'll have to add a link in the show page where we do that. The Philippine Pact by Claude Barabé. It came out in almost a year ago. And there's a great a picture on the front. Now, we teased Claude. He was talking about the problems around Bob L. Mandrab. Anyway, where the Houthis are making trouble right now in his first novel. And by the way, Claude, with a new publisher, has just put out the second edition of his books under slightly different names. So I'll embarrass him more, but he'll take the embarrassment because I'm giving him a free plug. So just go over to Amazon and enter Claude Barabé, and you'll see the second edition of some of his books that have come out recently. But yeah, you know, that another example where after we've talked about this once or twice, and I hope is going on again, if it's not right now, maybe the next administration will do it, is after 9/11, the Pentagon got a group of fiction writers together and had them brainstorm where things could go. That is a great thing to do. And Claude would always be on my short list of people. Plus, he has a naval background, and he's got a PhD in history from Leeds. I think I got it right. If not, he's going to send me a nasty note. But educated, smart people and authors who write fiction or study history, they can help us interpret what requirements are going down the road in coordination with those you usually would suspect, because inside the uniformed military, and especially inside the military bureaucracy or the civilian side, there's a lot of rice bowls. There's a lot of parochialism. There's a lot of stale thought. But yeah, you know, Claude is one of those authors who's kind of looked through his prism into the future and has been able to locate some of those spots. And the Philippines is clearly one. And you have to give a nod to the decision makers in Beijing. They're not dumb. They're smart. They're picking the right spots. So good on them, but it's up to us to, if we can't at least stay half a step in front of them, at least robustly respond when they do find a little soft spot when they're poking their bayonet.
Well, they've been poking us too. I mean, but in light of what you just said about gathering the authors, John Ringo and one of his science fiction books called A Hymn Before Battle, talked about a gathering of science fiction writers to deal with an alien threat. So it is a good way to approach things. Sometimes fiction writers have a better insight into the minds of other people than the guys who are writing op orders. Yeah, I mean, they pushed us. Remember the stuff they did with some of our USNS ships out there, and you know, they would capture one of our unmanned undersea operation things, and they would fish it up and look at it, and we'll never forget the EP3 episode, right? Where, I mean, the guy crashes into our aircraft, they land, and then they go through the aircraft and discover all the whatever's in an EP3. So,
and they make us take it apart to get it out of there. And if I was working with the PRC, I would have done the same thing. That was a gift.
Yeah, well, we did do the same thing. We, you know, every time we got somebody to fly a aircraft to freedom, then we would get it, and somehow it would always end up in Nevada somewhere.
Oh, you flew your MiG-25 into Japan. Well, the Japanese need to do a customs inspection of it. They should be through with the customs inspection in a couple of weeks. We'll give it back to you, I promise. Yep. Well, speaking of free gifts, it looks like we have gifted our listeners an extra few minutes of time. So I guess we should wind it up. We got through most of my list. Did you have any saved rounds you wanted to push down?
Let's see. No. We're good.
Well, for everybody...
Unless you want to mention ISIS and Russia, because it is interesting to me that Putin really is trying to blame that all on the Ukrainians when it's clear that the Ukrainians had nothing to do with it. But it also points out we need to be concerned about similar things likely happening in our country.
Yeah. In both Russia and here, politicians know the old Rahm Emanuel phrase, never let a crisis go to waste. Just, I think it should be obvious to everybody. It's not if, but when we have the next large-scale terrorist attack. And the last thing we need to do is to let politicians take the easy and short route and respond to external terror threats by cracking down on the liberties and freedoms of American citizens as opposed to going after the actual perpetrators. I still look at what we did with the Patriot Act back after the 9/11 attacks, and that's a classic example of overreach that still hasn't been corrected in a lot of areas. But everybody should gird their loins. What happened in Moscow will happen here. We just don't know when. We just don't know where. And we make it quietly. We don't even start.
call it a night.
Just call it a night. Next weekend, of course, is Easter for everybody to celebrate. Happy Easter. However, my Orthodox friends tell me that it's happening this summer. I don't know. And we do have guests lined up in April, and we appreciate everybody joining us and everybody in the chat room. We also appreciate you coming in and sharing. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.